just don't know why. Guys want you everywhere we go. Start at the mouth when you pass the door. Men watch the way you walk. Want a chance so they can talk. Even drop the numbers on the floor. Men bow if you tell them so. Men are mad about my girl. Women angry all over town. Talk about player haters. Men want you for themselves. Talking about the player haters. Men want you for themselves. She got a gap between her hips. Make me cry when she leaves. Men are mad about my girl. Women angry all over town. I'm about to play a hater. Men want you for themselves. Talking about the play a hater. Men want you for themselves.
I don't know why. They always hating on me and you. It's something that we got that making them mad. Every time I get up in the morning, I look at you, I see why. Cause you're so fine.
Men are mad about my girl. Women angry all over town. Talking about the player hater. Men want you for themselves. Talking about the player hater.
Getting up early in the morning looking at you, I see why the men always drop their number. Cause you are so fine. And you all mine.
Talking about the player haters. They want you for themselves. Haters, backstabbers. You want her for yourself.
I ain't gonna lie. thinking about the possibility. You may not be the best looking girl in the place, but from where I'm standing, you sure got a pretty face. When you back that thing up, oh yeah, you sure look good to me, baby. When you back that thing up, oh yeah, you sure look good to me, baby. I sure like what I see. Back it up, baby.
Good morning, you're listening to Amandla on CKLN 88.1 FM, and thank you for tuning in. My guest this morning is Fareed Omar, an intellectual community activist and engaged citizen. This morning we'll talk about the elections, the NDP rise in popularity, and what this means for diaspora communities in Canada and in Africa. Good morning, Fareed.
Thanks, Kalshan.
So, good morning. Good morning. So, Fareed, what do you think about what's going on with the NDP?
It's interesting, like the NDP surge. Mm-hmm. I think it's something people, activists, and many Canadians have been looking for a very long time. Mm-hmm. It was bound to happen at some point, but it's happening now, which is extremely important for Canadian politics, because it will bring the change that people really need. People have always looked to socially oriented party in Canada, which is only the NDP, mm-hmm. which represents that socially oriented spectrum in the political sphere here in Canada. And I think that people who are concerned about social programs like healthcare, education, pensions for seniors, and many more, as well as settlement services, an independent foreign policy, have the opportunity now to have their voice heard loud and clear on Monday when they go out and vote for the NDP. Like I said, it's an unprecedented political event in Canada. The NDP hopefully will paint the Canadian political landscape orange come Monday. Mm-hmm. And I think it's interesting time, because the big parties, the traditional business-friendly parties that have governed for so long, the Conservatives and the Liberals, have always served corporate interests. But now the NDP is on the verge of breaking that fold by challenging the status quo, because it's the only party that does not subscribe to the dictates of the status quo. Mm-hmm. And so it has that opportunity to make history in Canada by being the first left-leaning party that will have enormous influence in the Canadian politics for many years to come.
Fareed, you're talking about the domination of the Liberals and the Conservatives in the political sphere for a long time. Although this seems democratic in theory, it's also very political and very strategic. So it seems like the system was established to kind of work for two parties. Do you think that there needs to be a reform in the election process for it to be more, I guess, democratic and, I guess, easy for people to understand? And
that's a very important question, because right now the Canadian system is one which is called fast past the polls. Mm-hmm. Which means that any party with a single majority, despite the fact that it doesn't have the majority of the support, can form a government. Mm-hmm. For example, a political party only needs to garner about anywhere from 38 to 40% of the popular votes, which translate into a majority of seats, and then govern while the majority of the people did not actually vote for that political party. Mm-hmm. The NDP has been calling for a reform of the Canadian electoral system so that it will make it more inclusive. So it has always proposed a proportional representation system. And hopefully if the NDP gains a strong foothold come Monday, it will have the ability to push for proportional representation, of which in the past, when the NDP used to get about 20 to 25% of the votes, that did not reflect in the number of seats it got in parliament. Mm-hmm. It had seats far less than that. Even look at the Green Party. In the last election, they had something like 9 to 10% mm-hmm. of the votes, but they didn't have even a single seat. Mm-hmm. But if there was a proportional representation, they could get at almost 9% of the seats in the House of Commons. Mm. So I think proportional representation will be a more democratic and a more inclusive system. And it's only the NDP and the Green Party that have been calling for this. But I think, like, with the NDP's surge, and given the fact that now the NDP will be in the driving seat come Monday, one of the things it will bring on the agenda is to bring electoral reform, and it will have the clout now to push for electoral reform, in which we will have hopefully a new system of proportional representation in parliament.
And in talking about electoral reform, do you think that we need to have online voting so that more people can vote? Because obviously now there's a big problem with a few people actually going to vote.
I think the online voting is an excellent idea, especially for young people mm-hmm. who are internet savvy. It will be a great opportunity for them to vote. Even Canadians overseas and abroad mm-hmm. Can vote also online, and it will be an easy way also to tally the votes, mm-hmm. Being electronic. Mm-hmm. So I think technology should be part of that, so that we have an online voting that will allow people who can make it to the polling stations mm-hmm. To vote online. I think that's a great idea. It should be part of the electoral reform in addition to proportional representation.
And earlier you were talking about NDP being a progressive social kind of party. I remember during one of the debates, they were the only party that actually brought a very brief discussion on the environment. I was very surprised and actually kind of disappointed that there was very little debate or discussion about the environment or climate change or even Aboriginal issues, considering the fact that young Aboriginal people now or First Nations people are a big proportion of the voting bloc.
It is true. The NDP, despite the surge, has been disappointing in some fronts. The First Nations issues you mentioned, as well as the issue of the environment, mm-hmm. which will be key, especially with the oil sands in Alberta. Mm-hmm. I remember in the last elections, the NDP made the environment one of its key issues. But that discourse has been lacking in this campaign. Also, a lot of people were disappointed when the NDP joined the other parties like the Liberals and the Conservatives to vote for the no-fly zone in Libya. Mm-hmm. So that was a very disappointing to take a stand that is hawkish and pro-war. Mm-hmm. But I think it's up to the supporters, the base, the people who will be voting for the NDP mm-hmm. To demand that the party stick to those progressive lines, mm-hmm. that it should have a strong platform in the environment, mm-hmm. especially on how to deal with the carbon emissions mm-hmm. and the oil sands, as well as address issues pertaining to First Nations people mm-hmm. And be strongly anti-war. So, yes, there have been those disappointments. But I hope with a stronger mandate, the NDP should rethink and be in tune of what most Canadians are looking for in terms of environment and other progressive issues.
And what are you looking at? What are the things that you're looking for in terms of what you'd like to have the government or whoever the next government will be achieve for you in particular? Like, what are the important issues for you? Like, military, like no military intervention?
Yeah. First of all, for the young people, we know that education is now being priced out of the reach of the poor, especially people from immigrant communities. And it's an attempt to make it elitist and to shut out people from the education system and economic opportunities. So I would like the NDP to introduce a grants-based education system as opposed to loans. This is Canada is a very wealthy nation, and Canada can afford to bring in a grants-based education system where education is a right and not a privilege, so that everyone should have access to education. The other one is healthcare. We can see the healthcare system is being eroded. It has been eroded by the conservatives and the liberals before. There are long waiting lists for most procedures. There is the danger of the attempts to establish a two-tier healthcare system. So we would like to see a universal healthcare system that includes pharmacare, where people can also have access to free prescription drugs. Also, just recently, the Harper government has slashed funding to settlement programs. Mm-hmm. And this will definitely hurt immigrants and refugees who are trying to adjust to their to new life in Canada. Mm-hmm. We would like to see a restoration to funding to community organizations, to community groups. Even women organizations have suffered under Harper due to cuts to spending. You talk about international development. We have seen organizations like Kairos that have lost their funding. We would like to see like the new government in which the NDP will play a key, the new like parliament in which, or even government, the NDP can win this outright. Anything can happen. To be progressive in terms of foreign aid, the Harper government has slashed foreign aid to Africa. And we would like to see increased foreign aid that is not tied to any condition to fund endogenous development in the African continent. And in terms of war, we would like to see Canadian troops pulled out from Afghanistan immediately, right away. And Canada also should not participate in the war in Libya. It is now contributing fighter jets in the war in the so-called no-fly zone against Libya. Mm-hmm. They should leave the Libyan people to solve their problems. And also, we spoke about the environment. Canada should play a key role in curbing in dealing with emission rates, and also to put a halt or moratorium to any new developments with the oil fields in Alberta.
What do you think of, you kind of alluded to this a little bit earlier, what do you think about Harper's strategy to target women voters and immigrant voters? We've seen him specifically go to like communities in like Mississauga or Brampton, you know, targeting immigrant communities to vote for him. Meanwhile, he hasn't really done much for communities. For immigrant communities, for example, he's slashed funding to agencies that help new immigrants settle, and also child care for women, yes, more specifically. In fact, Canada has been last in 2004 when OECD did a poll on which countries are doing well. Canada was the last in developing countries in investment on social programs and on child care. And in 2008, UNICEF did a report card, and Canada was the last place again in terms of child care, and it only achieved 1 out of 10 performance benchmarks. What do you think will happen you know, if NDP or another party was to come into power, or if Harper was to come back, it would be more of the same, you think?
First of all, I think it is shameful on the part of Stephen Harper to try and solicit votes from women and young children, and young people, because like you said, his policies have impacted very negatively on these two very important sectors of society. He thinks that he can manipulate his way into soliciting those votes from women and young people, but I think it will be a total failure. Actually, he is scared because he has realized that the NDP is gaining ground on those two constituencies, women and the young people. And that's why he's trying to position himself as someone who will do who is something positive for women and young people. But people know very well where he stands, and I don't think anyone will come out that women and young people will go and vote for him. They will just dismiss those attempts as hypocritical, and I will also say disparate in these later stages of the campaign. You talk about childcare, access to childcare, and Canada ranking last in Western countries. What we will want an NDP-dominated parliament or an NDP-led government to do is to introduce a national childcare system that is government-funded and government-run, so that families and women will have access to a childcare system that is affordable and subsidized or entirely funded by the federal government. I think that will be an important step in terms of achieving those goals. Will NDP, the NDP meet its promises? It's a wait and see game, but I think that they have to heed the public's pressure now, the public's stance that the people in Canada want to see more investment in social programs. And that largely explains the surge in the NDP popularity. We don't want to see what happened in the U.S. when young people and other progressive sectors of society en masse voted for Barack Obama, who later on betrayed young people and others by staying on the course, by remaining with the status quo. People believe that Layton and the NDP represent leadership they can trust. Like I said, this is not unlike Barack Obama, who came from the Democratic Party, which was a party within the status quo realm. The NDP sees its has presented itself as a party that is not within the sphere of the status quo. It has positioned itself as a party that represents the interests of the ordinary people, ordinary Canadians. So at the end of the day, it is up to the people to put pressure on the NDP to retain its progressive, socially oriented platform.
You were alluding earlier to the fact that Canada is doing well, and some of the reasons why it's doing well is based out of they have Canadian companies are in African countries doing mining and that sort of thing, and also domestically they're doing well in terms of industry. Do you think Canada and whoever will come in power has a responsibility to developing countries in Africa, for example? And should Canadians want or expect them to be involved and invested in developing countries and the well-being of other people in general outside of Canada?
Okay, I just said that the Canada is a wealthy nation, but at the same time, we should be aware of the fact that Canadian corporations are reaping billions in profits, but largely through exploitation of cheap labor, in Africa, and also exploitation of Africa's resources. Mm-hmm. We need to see a change in terms of corporate social and environmental responsibility when it's come to Africa. Mm-hmm. We want these corporations to be held responsible and accountable for gross violations of human rights. Mm-hmm. Right now, these corporations have a free hand in Africa in terms of ravaging Africa's resources. Mm-hmm. And the conservative government has, and the liberal government before, has been protecting these corporations and have paid a blind eye to the gross human rights violations that have been committed by these corporations. So in the new political setup that is unfolding, we will demand that these corporations be held accountable in such a way that the people of Africa have full control in the decision-making process as far as mm-hmm. Their resources as are concerned. The people should determine how their resources should be exploited. And I think at the end of the day, the resources should be in the hands of the African people. And the NDP should pursue that policy mm-hmm. To ensure that Africa retains full control of its resources mm-hmm. and that there should be no more human rights violations and exploitation of labor and resources in Africa by powerful Canadian corporations that have been ravaging Africa for so long.
I've also noticed a lack of real dialogue in the debates. I'm not sure whether you have noticed the same thing, but the questions that were posed were very basic and not really the questions that I think many of us want to hear our politicians address. What do you think about that?
It is true, because in the first place, the Harvard government was brought down on the question of parliamentary democracy due to its contempt to
parliament.
Yeah, the parliament and democratic mm-hmm. institutions. Mm-hmm. And so, in the early days of the campaign, the issue of parliamentary democracy dominated the field of debate. Mm-hmm. But the real issues, especially in terms of social programs and issues that affect the people directly, mm-hmm. Have not been addressed in this debate. Like you mentioned, the environment and also the situation when it comes to foreign policy, mm-hmm. there has been nothing about the unfolding scenario in North Africa and the Middle East. Where mm-hmm. does Canada stand? Mm-hmm. Does Canada support the revolutionaries, or does Canada support despotic regimes, or does Canada support the invasion of countries like Libya, which is happening, like the no-fly zone? So these things are very critical, mm-hmm. and it is sad that the political debate has been narrowed to such an extent that a lot of things have not been addressed. Mm-hmm. But let's hope that in post-election period, mm-hmm. The people will put more pressure for all political parties to address these issues. But I will say that on the ground, mm-hmm. The candidates who are campaigning on the ground, mm-hmm. Especially NDP candidates, have in the local setting, they have been mentioning a lot of that. But in the national debate, mm-hmm. I agree, a critical debate has been missing yes. in this election.
And what do you think of the shutout of the Green Party from the debates? Was that justified or?
It was undemocratic, I think. Media consortiums should not determine who should be on political debates in Canada. I think it was undemocratic and shameful. Mm-hmm. And I think that in future, political debates, especially televised national debates, mm-hmm. should not be left to the dictates of TV networks that mm-hmm. are pro-business, pro-corporate.
Yeah.
It should be up to the parliament and the people of Canada to decide what should be, who should be on the debate. And of course, the people want every legitimate leader to be on the debate. So I think this should stop in the future.
Yeah, I think it was very unfortunate that we had a very short window for elections, and then a huge chunk of that time was eaten up by the whole Will and Kate's wedding, and it just took it sidetracked the whole election discussion. And the media was completely focused on the wedding. Meanwhile, we have real issues, you know, to think about, and the future of Canada.
Yeah, again, that's what the main political parties, especially the Liberals and Conservatives, mm-hmm. Will have left some more mm-hmm. to divert attention from real issues.
Mm-hmm.
And the media is deliberately doing the same
mm-hmm.
to divert attention from the public by focusing on the royal wedding.
Mm-hmm.
But the people have been using social media
mm-hmm.
to get the issues out.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this election, there's been widespread use of the social media mm-hmm. by young people,
mm-hmm.
Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
And I think young activists should continue in future to use social media
mm-hmm.
to send their message across so that people are enlightened of what's happening
okay.
in Canada.
Wow, thank you very much, everyone. Please remember to go and vote on Monday, and thank you for your time.
Thanks, Carson. Thank you very much.
Ooh. Oh, yeah. Well, I know some time ago I and stay out all night long. They said, look at him, they go again, out doing some woman wrong. I know I like to party and come in at the break of day, but if that's what I like to do, you can say what you want to say. 'Cause that's my bed, that's my bed, that's my bed. Well, that's my bed. Sorry,
that's my bed, but that's my bed.
Oh yeah, that's my bed, y'all.
That's my bed. Oh, that's my bed.
Cheat sometimes and have to tell a lot of lies, but it still ain't none of your business if my wife stay by my side. People are always talking about what you see me do,
and but I tell them. You are listening to CKLM. This is Saturday Morning Live. My name is Jalali, a.k.a. Norman Otis Richmond. And joining me in the studio is Melinda Francis. And we're getting ready to talk to Dr. Gerald Horn. I was looking at the book Mau Mau in Harlem just before I walked out of the door. And I was thinking about Mau Mau in Harlem because I think whatever the guy's name, who just proposed, had the big wedding.
I think
he proposed to his wife, the new queen, in Kenya. Am I right in saying that, Mr. Horn?
Well, I believe that you're referring to the Duke and Duchess of Cambridge, so anointed just within the last 24 hours.
Yes, I am.
That is to say, the former Kate Middleton and Prince William, and yes, he did propose to her in Kenya. That is accurate.
All right, and I guess I wanted to ask you the first question. I wanted to talk about May Day. I was going to let Melinda do that, but I'm sort of taking over because I had some stuff I wanted to talk about. In terms of May Day, here in Toronto, the the immigrant movement has energized the Mayday situation here, and the immigrant movement also energized the Mayday affair in the United States. And I was watching, the real Clarence Thomas on Democracy Now!, and he was talking about, we know that Mayday began in the United States, and they are talking about re-energized Mayday with the labor movement and the immigrant movements coming together. How do you see that?
Well, I think that that's something that is in fact happening. As you correctly suggest, Mayday had its origins, ironically, in the United States over struggles around labor militancy, the eight-hour day and the like in the late 19th century, although it's ironic because Mayday is probably observed less in the United States than any other country in the world. In fact, those who ruled this country proposed as an alternative to May Day, Labor Day, which is the first Monday in September, as a way to try to undermine the idea of workers all over the globe coming together, marching in the streets on May 1st. I should also add that May 1st has longer antecedents. Those who are familiar with Western European history generally and British history might recall that going back centuries, there were festivals around May 1. Not least because it was seen as a day of renewal, a day of spring, a day of warmth after a cold winter. So there's much to celebrate on May Day, not least being this idea of the labor movement and immigrant rights movements coming together. But before we go a step further, let me mark also on this last day of April of 2011, this anniversary that's very significant, and I'm talking about two sides of the same coin. It was in April 1994 that you had the first democratic elections in South Africa, which really was a major setback for the right-wing reaction when the apartheid rulers and their descendants were basically turned out of office in the African National Congress, and its Congress of South African Trade Unions and Congress and South African Communist Party allies came to power, where they still remain. And it was also in April 1994 that you had one of the darkest days, if I may use that particular phrase, in African history, because that was the time when you had the Rwanda genocide. 800,000, perhaps a million Rwandese basically slaughtered, like so many cattle. It was a very unfortunate time, and of course Canada played a very pivotal role because Roméo Dallaire, the Canadian military officer who was the head of the United Nations forces, was seeking vainly to rally the international community to intervene, but the international community basically turned its back and allowed the slaughter to proceed. It's a very unfortunate time, and we all know that since that time, Roméo Dallaire has had certain kinds of stress disorders as a result of what he witnessed, and has also been the subject of a number of documentary films, and in fact has written a memoir as well that's well worth reading.
Now, I wanted to stay on May Day for a couple of moments. Now, May 4th, I think it was a Tuesday on 1886, that's when the actual situation had, the actual events that led to the commemoration of May Day took place in Chicago, and at that particular time, Chicago was the fastest growing city in the world at that particular time in the 1890s. Could you talk about the mix of people that had come to Chicago from the South, from the southern parts of the United States, Eastern Europe, and what did that look like in terms of people coming to Chicago? And Chicago is a town that many of our greatest people were born in Chicago. George Jackson, Gil Scott Heron, Boots Riley of the Coup, also I think Ricky Henderson. And all of them left and went someplace else. You know, they were born in Chicago. Could you talk about, how Chicago came into being?
Well, Chicago, in the 20th century at least, was known as the second city. That is to say, it was the second most populous city behind New York. Now it's the third most populous city in the United States behind Los Angeles and New York. Chicago has ever had a very versatile mix of individuals. You may recall that a man of Haitian descent, Du Sable, is given credit for founding the modern city that is Chicago. And since that time, as you correctly suggest, it's had a very varied mixture of peoples of African descent, not only from Mississippi, from where hailed Richard Wright and Oprah Winfrey, to mention two amongst many, but also from the Anglophone Caribbean, from West Africa, from various parts of Africa. One of the largest Polish populations outside of Poland. You have a very varied mixture of peoples from Eastern Europe, a large Irish, particularly Irish Catholic population. The retiring mayor, Richard Daley, who, of course, was preceded by his father, Richard Daley, was of Irish Catholic descent. Large Italian-American population, large European population generally, and now, within the past few decades, you've had a spiraling population of both Puerto Rican and Mexican descent to the point now where they put their stamp on that urban metropolis.
I also understand there are large numbers of Ghanaians and Nigerians in Chicago, and Jamaicans.
Oh, sure. Although, in all fairness, the most varied West African population, at least in south of the border in the United States, is probably in Houston, where you have the largest Nigerian population outside of Lagos, and of course the richest black person in Houston, and one of the richest in the city, is a man of Nigerian descent, Casey Lawal, who controls oil interests. And of course, oil is the connection between West Africa and the Petro Metro that is Houston, Nigeria being a large oil producer. And of course, there's a large Angolan population, a large Equatorial Guinean population as well in Houston. And the same holds true for Chicago.
I did not know that. I want to let, or Melissa.
Melinda.
Melinda. Oh, my goodness. Melinda Francis. Well, I'm having problems with this name.
I would like to know about the WikiLeaks and Guantanamo.
Well, there were revelations just a few days ago in papers all around the world. You know about WikiLeaks and Julian Assange, the man of Australian descent who set up this website where whistleblowers of various stripes can release documents from governments, from banking interests and the like. And the latest cache of documents concerned Guantanamo. Guantanamo, of course, is in Cuba, although it's illegally occupied by the United States. They've set up a kind of devil's island there, if you will. That is to say, a place of incarceration where are dumped so-called or would-be alleged, quote, terrorists, unquote. And what these WikiLeaks revelations concern basically could be grouped into three streams. One stream suggests that many people are deposited in Guantanamo for years, and there is little or no evidence that helps to substantiate why they're there. Sometimes the evidence is so threadbare that it helps to explain why their cases have not been taken to court. For example, if you have a certain kind of Casio watch, that's seen to be evidence of being a terrorist, because allegedly when Al-Qaeda had graduation ceremonies, they gave you this kind of watch, not least because it has a timing device, supposedly, that's very appropriate for setting bombs that can be detonated. But, of course, many people wear Casio watches of this type without even knowing how to spell Al-Qaeda, let alone affiliated with it. Then there's another stream of individuals who have been released from Guantanamo to various governments, not least the Saudi government, but have turned up on the battlefields of Iraq, of Afghanistan, and increasingly of Libya, which obviously raises questions. Which brings me to the third category, and that is to say Libyans. You may recall that after the spring of 2003, there was collaboration between the Gaddafi regime and the North Atlantic powers, which led to Mr. Gaddafi basically housing, if you like, some of these prisoners from Guantanamo in his own prisons. Since this eruption of violence in Libya some months ago, many of them have escaped and now are loosely allied with NATO forces against Mr. Gaddafi, although one has to wonder how long they will stay allied with NATO, quite frankly. And that leads to the point, which many of us have been making, which is that NATO is recreating Afghanistan, this time in the sands of North Africa, because the collaboration between al-Qaeda and the NATO forces, principally the United States, went sour after the Soviet Union collapsed, and it's not speculative to suggest that this current alliance between former Guantanamo prisoners and NATO will similarly go sour sooner rather than later. But since I broached the question of Afghanistan, I think it's important to note another revelation that's really quite shocking that was on the front pages of newspapers in the last 72 hours. And this goes to the question of where Canadian men and women are now giving their lives. I'm talking about the battlefields of Afghanistan, because apparently the leaders of neighboring Pakistan have been encouraging the leaders of Afghanistan to turn their back on the NATO forces to enter into an alliance with Pakistan and China against the NATO forces. And this is really quite curious, because even as we speak, perhaps the largest foreign investment in Afghanistan is a copper mine that's basically controlled by Chinese investors, and guarding and preserving that investment are NATO troops, presumably Canadian troops as well, certainly U.S. troops. And this Afghanistan escapade is getting curiouser and curiouser, as has often been said. That is to say, as these NATO forces are giving their lives, apparently the Afghan leaders are planning a big surprise for them. And it's difficult to see how this project is sustainable. And I might also say that this really calls into question the leadership of Mr. Harper and may influence Canadians as they troop to the polls a few days from now.
Monday is going to be a big day. We're going to be speaking about the elections in detail at 12 o'clock, and I think you're going to stay on the line for a few moments. But in terms of this Pakistan situation, I was listening to Democracy Now! Yesterday, and they were talking about the royal wedding, and in this discussion of the royal wedding, someone, whoever the guest was, talked about the drones, how President Obama has been dropping drones on Pakistan, but he mentioned the fact that in the 20s, Britain was dropping, was bombing Pakistan. It started, I guess, in the 20s. Do you know anything about that?
Oh, well, sure. As you know, Pakistan, before its independence in 1947, was part of British India, and beginning in the 1920s, but certainly well before then, because British tenure in South Asia stretches back decades, if not centuries, you had an escalation of violence, particularly as the movement that came to be symbolized by Mahatma Gandhi was gaining traction. It was also always anomalous that a small island monarchy like Britain could control such a sprawling swath of territory that was British India. I mean, look at the population figures today. India has a population of about 1.2 billion. Britain has a contemporary population of about 55 million. And you had a similar proportion in the 1920s. And obviously, Britain can only maintain its mandate and its diktat through the promiscuous use of violence, which it was rather adept at doing.
You're listening to Saturday Morning Live. We're on www.cklin.fm.
Why don't we just move over to Syria? What's the current update and situation there?
Well, it looks ever more bleak, I'm afraid, for the regime of Mr. Bashar al-Assad, the son of Hafez al-Assad, who Syria until his death in the year 2000 and basically bequeathed the country, if you like, to his son, an ophthalmologist, a very cosmopolitan figure, lived for years in Britain, speaks fluent English and French in addition to Arabic, but is under siege. Although, I think it's important to give a little balance to what's going on in Syria that helps to distinguish it from other countries like Yemen and Libya, for example. First of all, you might have noticed that most of the demonstrations are not taking place in the commercial an actual capital, that is Damascus, is taking place out in the provinces. And this is not least because there's a lot of nervousness on the behalf of the Syrian Christian community about these demonstrations. many of the Syrian Christian community feel that the demonstrations are exhibiting a kind of sectarian philosophy, a Salafist philosophy, if you like, and they're very nervous. Then you have about 1 million Iraqi refugees who have fled Iraq, not least because of the disturbances in recent years, and they're quite concerned about similar disturbances rocking Syria, and so you haven't seen many of the Iraqis in the front lines of these demonstrations either. Then, of course, there is a Sunni middle class, an elite class, that's concerned about rocking the boat because they feel that they profit quite handsomely from the Assad regime. It's fair to note that the Assad regime is a minority of a minority, that is to say the Alawite minority within Shia, and there are many Shia who also are rather nervous. But in any case, the demonstrations are proceeding apace, along with the violence that's been used to subjugate and subdue the protesters. Syria is also different from Libya in this sense. Syria has alliances. One of the curious things about Libya, which I think helps to explain the present dilemma and the present violence that it faces, is how little diplomatic support it could rally. I mean, it was the Arab League, which basically gave the NATO forces cover for this bombing campaign when they basically, in a sense, came out in favor of this bombing campaign. Of course, we know that Libya had support within the African Union, but the African Union is not living up to its potential, to put it mildly. And when South Africa turned its back on the African Union peace initiatives by voting at the United Nations in favor of Resolution 1973, basically authorizing this violent bombing campaign, it basically revealed and exposed further fault lines within the African Union. Syria, on the other hand, has a very close relationship with Iran. It has a relatively close relationship with both Hezbollah in Lebanon and Hamas in the Palestinian territories, specifically Gaza. You might have noted that within the last 24 to 48 hours, the United Nations Security Council took up a press statement, not a resolution that would have condemned the Syrian regime, but a press statement was blocked by Russia, with which Syria has had close relations going back to the days of the Soviet Union, and also by China. I think both Russia and China have been rather chastened by their failure to veto Resolution 1973, and they were not about to allow a similar kind of statement to emerge from the United Nations Security Council. Similarly, I would say the North Atlantic powers are rather nervous about Syria, despite the fact that I do think they would like to see Mr. Assad go. They're concerned about the opposition, just like they're concerned about the opposition in Libya, because Israel, in particular, is quaking in its boots in the wake of this Arab Spring. You might have noted that just within the last 24 to 48 hours, Egypt has brokered a peace agreement between Fatah and West Bank and Hamas and Gaza. You're going to have a national unity government in the occupied territories. Israel responded by saying that the Palestinians could either have peace with Israel or peace with Hamas, but not both, which was a very striking statement, because I would think that the Palestinians would say, we think the Israelis should get rid of that Likud, right-wing, colonial, racist, expansionist government before we talk to the Israelis. But, of course, Palestinians say, you know, we're diplomats, and that's a right for Israel to elect any government they like, just like we, the Palestinians, have a right to elect any government that we want. In any case, the Egyptians have also improved relations with Iran, which is a particular, which potentially is a game changer in terms of the Muslim world, since Egypt has been a stalwart of the Arab population transnationally, and Iran has been a stalwart of Shia Islam. So Israel is very nervous about these changes, as well as it should. On the other hand, I think that Israel is also nervous about a change in Syria, because they have a whole peace with Syria, and it has lasted for decades now. The question is, would a new regime in Damascus settle for a cold peace, or whether they would want a hot war in order to get Syrian territories presently occupied by Israel back under Damascus control?
Now, the Arab League, I understand the Arab League, in terms of the Libyan question, there were many people that didn't even show up for that vote. It wasn't really as overwhelming as it as the press makes it appear. Is that the case, or am I getting misinformation?
Well, yes, not only that, but Algeria in particular did not vote in favor of that resolution, and Algeria is one of the most important nations within the Arab League. Algeria in particular is justifiably alarmed by the sight of French fighter jets bombing North Africa, because French fighter jets not so long ago were bombing Algeria during Algeria's heroic war of national liberation against colonial control from Paris. I might also add that this promiscuous use of violence is sending a very dangerous signal. You might have noted that just a few days ago you had this bombing in Morocco that led to the killing of a number of non-Moroccans, including Canadians, if I'm not mistaken.
That is correct.
A tourist site was targeted. Morocco has been a supporter of this NATO campaign in Libya, and that has outraged many Moroccans. King Mohammed, who, like I'm afraid so many rulers in the Arab and Muslim world, claims that he's a descendant of the Prophet Muhammad, is also happens to be one of the richest men in the world. His population, of course, is not one of the richest peoples in the world, and that is a recipe for continued unrest. And so it seems to me that what's unfolding in North Africa as we speak is a titanic change that ultimately could not necessarily be good news for the NATO powers, which I think helps to shed light on why Canadians need to reassess their foreign policy, not only because of what's going on in the Arab world, but it's also clear that its relationship with the United States needs reconfiguration in light of the fact that the United States, it seems to me, is in decline. China is rising. The BRIC nations, Brazil, Russia, India, and China, South Africa, are rising. And a continued Canadian foreign policy that makes a big bet on Washington, it seems to me, is doomed to failure. And I think that that might have occurred to many Canadian voters, which is one of the reasons why Mr. Harper's party is doing so poorly in the polls.
It looks like Harper's party is doing pretty poorly, but the one that's really looking very bad is Michael Inatieff. I don't think that he is really that popular. He is, the way he came into power, I mean, being parachuted into Jean Augustine's riding, and then some people have said this is the conspiracy, not necessarily conspiracy people, theory people, but some people are saying that they're going to get rid of Mr. Inatieff and put in Bob Rae. That's going to be a better leader. I don't know what do you think about that?
Well, in retrospect, I think it does not require an oracle to come to the conclusion that bringing in Mr. Inatieff after decades of exile, including in the United States, to be a potential prime minister of Canada was not a very wise choice by the Liberal Party. Not only that, but while in the United States, he distinguished himself as a hawk, as a proponent of this criminal and illegal invasion of Iraq in the spring of 2003. And given the fact that going back decades, one of the points that's distinguished Canada and that has made Canada into what it is today, one of the points that helps to shape the national character of Canada, is that Canadians are proud of the fact that they're not the United States. And Canadians are very critical of the United States for justifiable understanding and understandable reasons. And so to parachute a man who had spent time in the United States, who, quite frankly, if you ask me, after Monday might be returning to the United States.
Could be.
Probably to Harvard, and, it wouldn't surprise me one bit. That was not a very wise choice, and I have to wonder what was on the mind of the party stalwarts. I mean, if you talk about conspiracy theory, maybe it was Bob Rae who manipulated the appointment of Mr. Inatieff, knowing that he would go down in flames and that there would be an opening.
For him.
For him.
Right. We're going to take a musical break, and we're going to come back with Liz Raleigh, and we'll take a music break, and you're going to stay on the phone for about 15 minutes, you said, Mr. Horn.
Yes, sir.
All right. This is a musical break. You're listening to Saturday Morning Live. Melinda Francis, Norman Otis Richmond, JP on the buttons, and we will be back.
Mm-hmm. for your love. From the very first time I laid my eyes on you, my heart said follow through. But I know now that I'm way down on your line, but the waiting still is fine. Don't talk to me as if you think I'm done.